As the U.S. attempts to pull out of Afghanistan after two decades of war in the Middle East, we size up the costs on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Since the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. has spent more than $2.2 trillion to finance the war in Afghanistan, that accounting by the costs of war project that has, since 2010, pooled the work of dozens of scholars to provide the fullest accounting of the human, economic, and political costs. What has the U.S. accomplished by being in Afghanistan? How do you feel about the war today? Was it worth it? 800-642-1234. Nita Crawford, she is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. She co-founded and co-directs the Costs of War Project, which is housed at Brown University. Nita, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be with you, Kate.
Well, we spoke in 2019 after the release of the Afghanistan papers, these documents revealing that top policymakers didn't see the Afghanistan war as winnable. Now, as we see the Taliban retake the country, what is your reaction?
Well, something that was foreseeable and foreseen is nevertheless still unfortunate. And even now, there are policy options for the United States. I wish I hope that we're creative in our responses.
When you say there are policy options for the U.S., what might those be?
Well, for example, the U.S. has already worked with its allies. Unfortunately, we didn't work with them on the withdrawal, but we're working with them now on putting diplomatic pressure on the Taliban to ensure that they keep the promises that they made. I don't know that we have too many levers, but that's one lever. A second thing that we can do is expedite, as we are, the removal of people who are at risk. Again, you know, mistakes were made, as they said, in the 1970s, and, you know, we're behind on that. Another policy option is to put pressure on Pakistan, using whatever leverage we can, who can then indirectly pressure the Taliban to behave better.
There are grave concerns that Afghans who aided the U.S. and their families are under violent threat from the Taliban if they remain in the country. Can you give us a sense of how much of that threat there is?
Well, I think it's real. Now, we don't know in every instance how many of the Taliban will obey the orders. They're an organization which is loose and necessarily so when you fight an insurgency. Chains of command are not extremely tight. People have autonomy. So even if at the top the order is given that you're not to engage in, quote, retribution for People's Alliance and working with the United States, that may not be the case. There still may be retribution. I suspect that, you know, as much as the Taliban has enjoyed the fact that they haven't had to govern all of Afghanistan, they now are faced with the reality of having to govern Afghanistan, and you can't kill everyone everywhere. You can't threaten everyone everywhere and expect to have people actually work with you. So there is a limit to what they will do.
Nita, how closely does the modern Taliban in this day resemble the Taliban that existed when American military forces invaded after the attacks?
Well, that's a good question that I don't have an answer to. I think if we knew the answer to that, we would have been better at actually engaging the Taliban. One thing that's true is that they've had tremendous turnover in leadership. You recall that year after year where we were told that the United States has killed the top leadership of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Oh, we've killed leader X. We've killed leader Y. But each time we've killed a leader, a new leader has arisen. So the leadership is younger. They may be angrier. They may also, and it's likely the case, be more willing to work with people than the previous leadership was. So there's contradictory tendencies. We don't really know enough, I think, about the leadership of the Taliban.
Nita Crawford is with us, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University, giving her assessment of the situation in Afghanistan, also through the lens of the Costs of War Project, which we'll be talking about here. You can join in with your assessment, 800-642-1234. Andrew is joining us from Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how's everybody doing this morning?
Doing well. What is your assessment?
My assessment would be that if you look at any of the foreign policy that the United States has had in the last 20 years in the Middle East and then through North Africa, looking at Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, every time that we have gotten involved, we've taken out top leadership, as your guest pointed out, but then there's a massive power vacuum and then you have conditions worsen for the people who live there. And I don't see why the United States should be continually involved in these wars where we send a bunch of young men over to get maimed or killed. And, you know, I don't see the benefit to it. And I think that people need to take a step back and really look at whether or not that's our role to be trying to go around the world and stick guns in people's faces and say, you're going to take our democracy and you're going to like it.
Andrew, thank you for calling in. Nita, you know, Andrew addressing the massive power vacuum, what do you see in his thoughts?
Well, he's raised a number of interesting points. I think that's right. This is an inexperienced group that's going to take over Afghanistan. They have been running large sections of the country. Recall that the United States has been losing this war for more than 10 years. They have had control of large sections of the country, but they haven't had to control this much territory this quickly. And I think that that's going to create issues for them. They may then get more violent, but on the long run, they'll have to become more cooperative with the citizens if they expect to have any kind of governance. On the larger issue of the United States engagement over the last, I'd say, 40 years since we decided that we had to go protect oil and make sure that there was access to oil, not just for the United States, but for the rest of the world. We have engaged in policies which are sometimes helpful and productive, but often they're counterproductive because they bolster governments which are friendly to our oil interests, but not democratic. And that leads to people in those countries protesting and disliking not just their government, but our government because we support their government. Mm-hmm. And that's the root of these insurgencies and sometimes these terrorist organizations in reaction to governments that are corrupt, as you know, the Afghan government was, and also bolstered by the United States in terms of advisors, arms, and sometimes even troops.
Andrew mentioned the casualties of war, and U.S. service members represent fewer than 1% of direct war deaths. That's your costs of war assessment, and I was kind of surprised by that because the devastating casualties that your project has found, by comparison, is quite breathtaking. Can you explain?
Well, in the long run, you know, over the last several decades, there's two things that have happened which have reduced U.S. casualties. One is there's been a great improvement in medicine, and many more people are surviving their injuries in the field because they're treated right there or they're evacuated quickly to a location where their injuries can be treated. So that's led to a decrease in the number of deaths. We still have tens of thousands of U.S. service members, men and women, who have been injured, sometimes gravely. And these are visible wounds and invisible wounds. And then the other way that the United States has reduced its casualties is to use air power. Now, when it uses air power from 15,000, 20,000 feet, and it's bombing urban areas or areas where they think that there's a concentration of militants, they're often harming not just militants, but civilians. Just the sheer size of the weapon, a 500-pound weapon detonated in an urban area will destroy a lot, directly with the blast, but then it will set off fires which kill more people or injure more people. So any time you use force, especially if you're using force from afar, you can't see who you're targeting necessarily or identify them, it's possible that you will kill civilians. And that's what we've done. And that's the other side as well. So the great toll of these post-9/11 wars on civilians is that we've used a lot of firepower, much of it from the air. And it's also the toll on civilians is also due to the fact that the other side doesn't necessarily care as much about civilians.
Mm.
They're both more desperate, and in some cases, they believe that they need to be coercive in order to get civilians to go along with them, to provide them with food or shelter or information about the U.S. and its allies.
We have Boston University political science professor Nita Crawford, co-directs the Costs of War Project. Her research delves deeply into the human, financial, environmental, the social costs of the post-9/11 wars. How has the war in Afghanistan affected your life personally? Do you know someone who has fought in Afghanistan? Have you been deployed to the Middle East? What are your thoughts on the images you see coming out of Afghanistan? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Nita Crawford here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing post-9/11 wars on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. War is expensive. That's from the Costs of War Project in a report last year. War is expensive in terms of lives lost, physical damage to people and property, mental trauma to soldiers and war zone inhabitants, and in terms of money, end quote. As Kabul fell on Sunday, reestablishing Taliban rule over Afghanistan for the first time in 20 years, we're checking in on those costs of war. With your insights, 800-642-1234. We have Nita Crawford, who chairs the political science department at Boston University, co-founded the Costs of War Project. Nita, the president told ABC News yesterday it was a simple choice to withdraw, and Biden faulted the Afghan government and its military for not more forcibly defending Kabul. Can you break down how that training has been for the U.S. and why the U.S. feels like the Afghan government didn't do its part?
Well, the United States spent a lot of effort equipping and clothing and paying and training the Afghan military police. Much of that effort actually accelerated later into the war. So it's not been 20 years or 19 and a half years of training, but it's accelerated. And I believe that there was still problems with that, in that there's the maintenance of the great advantage that the Afghan security forces had was of their aircraft. When the United States pulled contractors and its own personnel, military personnel, from maintaining aircraft, that made it much more difficult for the Afghan Air Force to maintain their own aircraft. Mm. They also had that's what they've used in many cases to sort of pull their ground forces out of danger by bringing in air power. The Afghan military also had logistical problems. Even getting ammunition to people was difficult, not to mention water and anything else they might need. Mm. So in instance after instance, they fought very hard, but and they fought hard for the last several years and taken many more casualties in terms of people killed and injured than external forces, international forces. So I believe that when they chose not to fight, for instance, in Kabul, they were wise in that it would have been difficult for them to win, given their challenges logistically. They were surrounded, and what they chose was not to lob weapons inside and outside the city, which would have necessarily, clearly killed many civilians.
Yeah.
So I believe it was the right thing to do to stand down in the face of that. And I think that that's the lesson of having been overrun in city after city, lacking the kind of capacity that they would have needed to win. And, with many years of taking a lot of casualties under their belt.
Yeah.
So I don't fault the Afghan military, especially for not fighting over Kabul. I think it was wise.
Nina Crawford, political science professor at Boston University, co-directs the Costs of War Project. Gathering your insights as well, what do you think of America's forever war? 800-642-1234. Rosa is joining us from Waterford. Good morning, Rosa.
Good morning, ladies. So my cousin Warner served in Afghanistan. He came in shortly after the initial invasion by America into Afghanistan. He said what he saw was that he and his fellow soldiers had to guard the poppy fields because the Taliban started burning the poppy fields, which makes the heroin. And shortly after they started burning the poppy fields, America invaded. So that's what the Taliban, in my opinion, is about. They don't want heroin made.
So it was the resources, the poppy fields, that Rosa is bringing up. Nita, what do you know about that?
Well, the United States has targeted all Taliban income, and that includes any income that they derive from basically shaking down local people at the point at gunpoint, and also by forcing Afghan farmers to grow poppy or enticing them to grow poppy because poppy is profitable. Mm. So what the U.S. and its allies have done is engaged in what they call counter-narcotics, and that entails burning and otherwise destroying with chemicals dropped from the air any fields that are used to grow poppy that the U.S. can find. And that's just simply the same kind of thing that we've done in Iraq and Syria. So when ISIS controlled oil fields, we would destroy the wellheads or the machinery used to extract the oil or the storage facilities for the oil, just so that we could cut off their income.
What does the Taliban's takeover mean for women and children?
Well, it's almost it's a double tragedy. First of all, war is always bad for women, children, very young people suffer much more than we can imagine, especially, but also older people, men and women. And what it means for non-combatant civilians is that on the one hand, perhaps the immediate fighting will end and they'll get some reprieve. But on the other hand, it means, I think, that it's likely that they'll see a return to the kind of draconian rule that the Taliban believes is essential.
What are you watching for next in Afghanistan? What are you keeping an eye on?
Well, I am worried about humanitarian catastrophe. That is, when the international community puts pressure on the Taliban to straighten up and fly right, that is, keep their commitments to protecting the rights of women, They may impose very harsh sanctions in order to get them to do what we believe is right, what I believe is right. But that can actually end up hurting the women and children you just mentioned more than even what the Taliban is doing. So we've got to be very careful. I'm looking at the international reaction to see how it's calibrated so that any sanctions that we impose are targeted and focused on the people who can actually change the policy. Mm-hmm. Another thing, of course, I'm watching is how the Taliban behave. And then finally, the rate of the U.S. withdrawal and evacuation of the individuals that we said we were trying to get out. If we can increase that, that'd be wonderful.
Nita, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Nita Crawford, Chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. At this hour, you have aligned to Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan. News update is next. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about reimagining archaeological digs on tribal lands.
Frog Bay Tribal National Park sits on the shores of Lake Superior. It's on the land of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, also known as the Anishinaabe. Frog Bay is the first tribal national park in the country, and for the last several summers, it's been home to a collaborative archaeological project between tribal leaders and university archaeologists. The goal is not just to find new artifacts, but imagine a new way for everyone to work together. A new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered has the story. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
For the last 3 years, the Red Cliff Tribal Historic Preservation Office has been collaborating with two archaeologists helping excavate sites on tribal lands. During these digs, students, researchers, and tribal community members work together to learn about the people who have lived on this land for millennia and to connect that knowledge with the people who still live here today, which for so long hasn't been the case of archaeological work.
Indian people has been studied to death. You know, study after study after study after study.
Marvin Defoe is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for Red Cliff, otherwise known as the TIPO.
They say, well, this is how they used to be. That's what they used to do. So that word they disconnects everybody in our whole community. We're here today, we're alive today, we ain't going nowhere, we're alive today, but there's a story on how we came to be.
The TIPO office is in charge of a lot of things. Things like the annual powwow, the language school, and making sure that none of the sacred sites get disturbed. So sometimes Marvin gets calls from archaeologists. Archaeologists like Heather Walder. Heather works at UW-La Crosse and the Chicago Field Museum.
I remember calling Marvin just cold to speak with the TIPO to talk about this project.
You know, when Heather gave me a call in Red Cliff, do you know of any place in Red Cliff that maybe we could kind of take a look at whatever? And I started thinking. I said, yeah, we go out Frog Bay.
The dig started at Frog Bay Tribal National Park in the summer of 2018. Asking tribal members for input is crucial as the group makes sense of what they find in the ground. For example, take the bunches and bunches of cracked rocks that were being found all over the site. Marvin had an idea.
Heat them up, put them in a container. I call that a Anishinaabe microwave oven, you know.
Marvin's Anishinaabe microwave came from a story he heard from an indigenous elder in Canada. That elder took his grandkids out for the weekend to share traditions. And one morning, they caught a fish and started a fire.
You know, so he took the fish, heated up them rocks, and had the trough, and he put that fish in there, and he put a little wild rice in there, and put them rocks in there, put the top on, wrapped it all up, and propped it in the bow of his canoe.
A few hours later, they had a delicious lunch cooked with hot rocks inside of a cedar log. Top Chef has nothing on this. Today, Marvin shared that meal with us. The same meal an elder shared with his grandkids just a few years ago. A meal that was shared with the people at Frog Bay who lived here 5,000 years ago.
We all have a job to do today. We all have a job to undo what happened to us as indigenous people. If you teach a child to love the land, that child will protect it. And part of how you love the land is you gotta understand yourself and love yourself as a native person. And it ain't just doing the archaeological thing, you live it. Zichigewin, you live it.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are demanding answers, planning to investigate what went wrong with the U.S. troop withdrawal. What type of international response should there be for Afghanistan? What do you want Capitol Hill lawmakers to know? It's 800-642-1234. Mark Pocan is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, including Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. Congressman Pocan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, your reaction first to the Taliban takeover.
It's always heartbreaking to see some of the imagery we're seeing from there. But, I think it's important to state that, we were going to see this at some point under some president, because I think this is a mission where all too often we try to go into a country, try to do a so-called nation building in countries that don't look very similar to ours. We don't have lots of success in this. And in Afghanistan, other countries have tried as well. And we even had more reasons to doubt 20 years ago the mission. And unfortunately, I think if we were there for another year or 5 years or 20 years, as the president said, we would have had very much the same result. Could there have been things done differently in the withdrawal? Yes. I think we should have started evacuating people earlier. But short of that, unfortunately, this is part of why many of us don't want to see our country go into countries and try to somehow remake them. It's not like we were going to leave Afghanistan and have a bunch of Dunkin' Donuts and Disneylands. And I think we've once again seen why this doesn't work.
The president yesterday said it was a simple choice to withdraw U.S. forces. And President Biden faulted the Afghan government and its military for not more forcibly defending the capital. What do you make of President Biden's comments to date?
Well, I mean, it's the obvious truth, right? I mean, we, again, tried to go in for 20 years. I think at times the Department of Defense and times intelligence got it wrong. Sometimes I think they try to placate the various administrations while they were there in the 20 years that we've been there. But, it was pretty clear that we weren't having measurable successes along the way. And it's especially clear watching this peaceful transfer that occurred in many ways that,
Can you characterize it as peaceful? I mean, when you see these...
Let me finish, Kate, and I'll tell you exactly why. In that they laid down arms and didn't oppose them. So, sometimes on the ground in a country, they may have a different look at what they want to be in the future rather than us. And unfortunately, watching how after 20 years we couldn't build that institutional support in a country different than what just happened is what many of us have seen and said for a long time. And that's why we say even 5 years or 20 years from now, the same very likely would have happened. So, unfortunately, there are a lot of hot spots in the world. I just was in the Situation Room at the White House on Yemen trying to deal with them. That is the largest humanitarian crisis on the planet right now, with 500,000 kids on the verge of starving. But we can't go into a country with the military, expect to somehow fundamentally change a country. And from the very beginning, the mission by Dick Cheney and George Bush was flawed. And it's terribly unfortunate. It was a loss of lives and a loss of taxpayer money. But at the end of the day, this hopefully is a reminder One, that we can't do this, just go into a country and think that we're going to somehow completely change it. And two, we have to get rid of the 20-year-old authorization to go into war that takes it out of Congress's hands as required by the Constitution and gives it to the president. So by peaceful, what I meant is they didn't have any resistance, because I think all along we've seen this, and unfortunately staying there wasn't going to change anything.
What might this mean for how other bad actors in the world treat and test President Biden? What does this fall look like in places where democracy is fragile?
Well, and that's why I think it's so important that we get the people who worked with the U.S. government out safely, and we do what we promise, get them to places like the United States, so that, one, they're safe from the Taliban, from any retribution, but two, we owe it to them because they worked with us during this time. If we don't do that, we send a terrible message in other areas where we may need to rely on people on the ground to help us, whether it be our forces or in other ways. So it is really important that we get this current mission done correctly.
Three Democratic-led Senate committees, your colleagues, and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, they've vowed to investigate what has gone wrong in the removal of U.S. troops. Do you support a formal investigation by congressional committees?
Well, we always should. But I think what we're going to find is they made some mistakes of assuming how quickly the Taliban would take over. Although, again, I think if you hear most people, there was a large assumption this would happen. It's just it happened quicker than they thought. Having said that, they probably should have planned ahead of time and started getting people out before we removed our forces. That's the larger mistake that occurred. But, you know, the problem is I don't want anyone, because there are some in Congress who absolutely love the military-industrial complex and want to continue to build it and build it and build it, and it's already such a large part of our budget, that just want to say, well, we should have just stayed longer. You know, we've seen that. In this country, it was obvious. Other countries have tried to do the same thing. It hasn't succeeded. Sometimes we just have to understand that we can't just go in there with military might and reform a country in a way that we want to. And I hope that's the lesson coming out of this.
But where's the breakdown in intelligence and intelligence on the ground? Why wasn't that getting through? I mean, this was surprising. Why should it have been surprising?
Well, not really. It was not surprising. CIA, for example, gave a less rosy scenario along the years. I do think the Department of Defense often gave administrations, both Democratic and Republican, overly rosy, saying what was happening on the ground, maybe a little bit too optimistically. And because of that, I think presidents who didn't want to do what Joe Biden did, which is pull that Band-Aid off because they knew it was going to be potentially ugly underneath, have kind of accepted those as the answers. And I think that will come out of some of this. Good examples. There's a great article from 2 years ago that did a great job outlining how off the military has been and how they've talked about it. But, you know, this was something that we've seen, unfortunately, before. I hope we can try to not have it happen again. But right now, the main mission we all have to focus on is getting not only all the Americans out, but everyone that worked with us, which could be up to 100,000 people.
Democratic Congressperson Mark Pocan stays with us as we discuss the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan, Taliban's quick takeover of the country. Have you been following the news surrounding Afghanistan? What concerns you most with the takeover? Are you a service member who has been deployed to the Middle East before? What is on your mind? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Congressman Mark Pocan here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan on the line as we discuss the situation on the ground in Afghanistan and how Congress is reacting to the Taliban takeover. President Biden said last month that a Taliban takeover of the whole country would be, quote, highly unlikely. We have Representative Pocan with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Jerry now in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. What is on your mind? Go ahead.
I just want to say, as a lifelong Republican, I totally support Joe Biden's decision. Somebody had to do it. He was man enough to do it. So that's all I got.
Representative Pocan, will this bring lawmakers together? What do you see from your Republican colleagues?
So I see this more from real people across the country that, you know, said we just can't go into every country in the world and try to remake it. And, you know, this was in many ways doomed from the very beginning, and someone had to make this decision. So I think, you know, what Jerry's saying, I have heard from other Republicans. Now, there is a faction, both of some Democrats, but more Republicans, who, you know, quite honestly are quite big defenders of the military-industrial complex and want us to see us in many countries and have troops around the world. So there's definitely a divide, I think, on ideology that does transcend party when it comes to whether or not we should be leading with more diplomatic efforts around the world, like a bill I recently introduced, the COVID Defense Act.
We're going to get to that in a moment. Yeah.
But the things like that is the contrast to the military intervention. I think there is an ideological difference of what approach is best for this country.
Well, you know, after years of war and now a pandemic, America appears to be turning inward with more of a focus on domestic problems instead of foreign policy. And it may not be outright America first that President Trump professed, but what do you think of this turn inward?
Many of us, again, I think this is another issue that in some ways transcends policies. Many of us have been very skeptical of some of the trade agreements because we want to make sure that we've got production in this country, especially with things like prescription drugs, et cetera. And again, I think that can transcend political parties. And in many ways, I think that's a good thing. You don't want it to be xenophobic, but you do want to make sure that we're not relying on China or India for our prescription drugs, or we're not relying on other countries for things like computer chips that we need. So, you know, hopefully maybe the silver lining out of what's happening is we realize that we need to do more to help companies stay here and have jobs here and don't create tax incentives that allow corporations to hide money overseas. Otherwise, they'll continue to do what they've been doing.
Let's go to Pamela in Milwaukee. Pamela, your thoughts?
Yes, hello. I just first want to congratulate Representative Pocan, Congressman Pocan, and his Defense Spending Reduction Caucus. I think it's a really good idea to not spend so much on military adventures overseas, and we won't have this problem in the first place. And also, just more Afghani civilians and military died in that war than U.S. contractors or military people. 4,000 contractors, 4,000 U.S. military, tragic, but 71,000 civilians in Afghanistan died and 74,000 military service people there. So there were many people that died there more than here, and I see that they didn't have the popular support because of all the death and destruction. You have to remember the mother of all bombs was dropped on Afghanistan, so I'm sure they were happy to have us leave. Thank you.
Pamela, thank you for your call. Congressperson, the loss of life.
You know, and I think it's so important the way the caller just brought that up is it's not just U.S. life, but it's life in Afghanistan. And, you know, this is again, another, I think, reason why when there is a situation around the world, there are other better ways, diplomatic ways to deal with it. Rather than just trying to use military might. And there's absolutely a reason and a time to use military might. But I think, you know, Afghanistan probably gives us a great example of after 20 years, what we weren't able to accomplish and how quickly all that work, all those lives and all the taxpayer money that was spent was just seems to have been not for the right reason when you watch things fall so very quickly.
Fort McCoy in Wisconsin preparing to receive an unknown number of Afghan refugees. Once these people are processed, what should Wisconsin do to help? What is our role?
We absolutely should be helping settle refugees. As I said, that's the main mission right now. And I think it's very important for other scenarios around the world that they know that we keep to our word. And that will be one of the facilities that will be housing folks as we're bringing them here.
talking with about Afghanistan with Mark Pocan, Democratic U.S. Representative from the 2nd Congressional District, taking your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to the COVID Defense Act, directing about 1% of the country's military budget to vaccinate low-income countries worldwide. Why should taxpayer money be spent on increasing vaccine availability outside the U.S.?
So for two reasons. One, we have an enormous defense budget, but just taking a little over 1%, 1.3%, $9.6 billion would match the international efforts so far through COVAX. That current money, the 9.6, is about 30% of the world's population in the 91 poorest countries are getting vaccinated. We can double that number with just a small portion of the defense budget. Not only does it help have goodwill vaccine diplomacy in a way I think that would work better than what we just got done doing in Afghanistan, but also you're never going to stop variants until you vaccinate more people in the world. So it's in our best interest to make sure the world gets vaccinated as quickly as possible. We have the resources and the ability to do this, and China is currently doing this and using it for goodwill for their country, but their vaccines aren't as good. We have a real opening to accomplish a number of goals by doing this, and the COVID Defense Act will do just that.
Are you getting any traction with it?
We just put it out for a co-sponsorship yesterday with members, but we've got a number of groups that have already come on endorsing it, and I think that's the important part right now. People see this as a real opportunity to get more of the planet vaccinated, which, again, ultimately will help make sure we don't have variants to get out of the period that we're currently in this country and around the world. And I think you're going to see a lot more groups come out and support this.
The WHO, the World Health Organization, condemning wealthy nations like us that have plans to roll out booster shots, saying it hurts the rest of the world, risking poor nations who don't have the shot. Are you concerned about booster shots being given in the U.S. when many countries aren't able to distribute vaccines yet?
I think you can do both. You know, it's not as much of a question on production right now. It's really on just getting people vaccinated. And in some cases, we've watched in some southern states where vaccination rates are low, they've actually had to destroy a vaccine they haven't used. So I think we can really do both, make sure that people in our country are protected, but also help on the international efforts. And we can ramp up production if necessary. So this is something, it doesn't have to be an either-or situation.
President Biden has, going back to Afghanistan, you know, vowed to end the forever war, but is really facing a backlash right now for how quickly the situation has deteriorated. Do you think what you're going to see unfold in the days ahead is warranted for President Biden to take the blame?
Well, I think you can take the blame for the last 20 years, starting with the original mission. And when you look at how Dick Cheney and George Bush originally laid out the mission and completely refused to have any sort of conversations even with the Taliban, which clearly had a presence there, and any kind of power sharing or anything else, we were set up in many ways for failure from day one. So, you know, Donald Trump is the one who initiated this process somewhat awkwardly, I will admit. But someone ultimately had to do this. And as your first caller on this program, Jerry, had mentioned, you know, a lot of people just want us to not be involved at this level across the globe. And we're going to do what we need to now by getting people back safely. But hopefully this is a lesson for the future. We don't make the same mistake.
Representative, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kate.
Mark Pocan, Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.